This is the Commodity Culture Podcast, where we interview prominent investors, fund managers, analysts, and company CEOs to give you an edge when it comes to investing in the commodity space. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Commodity Culture, where our goal is to make you a better investor in the commodity space. My name is Jesse Day. Before we dive in, as always, standard disclaimer, nothing here is investment advice. Do your own due diligence. And today's guest is a professor of organic chemistry at Cornell, an investor and a contrarian thinker who is often controversial and always compelling. It's Dave Collum. How you doing?
Well, thank you. By the way, if you were to give advice to the opposite of what I say, that would be the best advice you could give.
Perfect. Do the opposite of everything Dave says. Well, I want to start with a broad question, and you can take this anywhere you'd like. And that is, what are the main trends and themes you're currently paying attention to when it comes to the markets? That could be the broad market, potential overvaluation in the S&P and the NASDAQ, or anywhere you want to go with this.
So I'm a believer that we're going to have decades of pain. I've made the case, and a lot of people don't know that, but if you look at an inflation-adjusted S&P over the 20th century, there are periods of 40 to 75 years where it treaded water. So if you go from 1929 to 1981, you made nothing. All you got were dividends minus taxes, minus fees, and stuff like that. So owning at the top is a disaster. If you're a trader, ignore everything I say. You buy low, sell high, right? But most of us just kind of buy and hope. And I think we're going to go through one of those periods. I think I have a round number, 150% overvalued. I had an epiphany yesterday, actually. I was listening to Russell Napier, who you should get on if you can. He would be way better than me. And I had said for several years in a row that the markets were sort of 50% over historical fair value, which is a pretty flat line, actually, just oscillating around some metric like PE or whatever. And then in 1994, they took off. They never looked back. And so recency bias is now 30 years. Now, you could assume that they're never going to go back, but We know that anyone who does that draws scorn almost immediately. Anyone who claims the regression of the mean is no longer an issue. And then yesterday, Russell Napier said, and I've been trying to figure out why, and he said that it was in 1994 that China pegged the yuan to the dollar. And that the effect of it was far faster than people thought. And all of a sudden I go, that might be it right there. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to put it together yet. What's bothering me? It feels like we are at total stall speed at this point. It has been put off by, the problems have been put off by the fact that it's an election year and everyone's giving away unbelievable amounts of free money. But you and I both know that if you're growing your debt at 7-8% a year and your GDP is growing at 2.5% or something, then you're going to lose, period. I don't know when, but you're going to lose. So I can't, valuation is a terrible metric for timing, but it's a metric that says it may not be imminent, but it is an imperative that it regress to the mean. There's never been an overvalued asset class that didn't eventually regress to and through the mean. So I name one. There's never been a currency that didn't eventually die too. It's one of these truisms, right? There's no one's ever lived forever. So the point being is that we are going to go off a precipice at some point here. I think we're 150% overvalued, which means we're talking 60, 70% to get to the historical mean, which means to get to a price where if you buy it at that point, you will get the historical return. And so you better have cash when you get there. Now, I played the first three decades of my investing career well. Through the noughts and the last decade through the teens, I missed a big part of the equity run. No question about it. I thought we're not done. And somehow $30 trillion later, they managed to keep the markets going up. What a shock. But I have a rule of thumb. Don't do anything that if it fails badly, you won't forgive yourself. So if I buy, one of the things that keeps me out of Bitcoin, for example, is if I put a bunch in and then it fell badly, I'd say you knew better. I buy gold, I wouldn't say you knew better. So I'm hunkered down. And I think what I'm seeing, here's what I think I'm seeing. I have files full of indicators that say things now are starting to crumble. And you can see the unemployment situation starting to show, workers are becoming more available, the housing market's starting to develop inventory, the price with developing inventory starting to come down, things like that. And it's the coyote moment. I hate trite metaphors. I'd rather invent a new creative and usually semi-pornographic one. But I really do think that there's a muscle memory to all this stuff. And at some point, all of a sudden, investors say, oh, wow, something is happening. And then you get the emergent system where the cascading failure begins. And then you just step back. It's like a hurricane or something. You don't tie yourself to a tree. You find safe haven. You know, it's an earthquake. You know, it's when it finally comes, it unleashes a lot of energy. And so I think we're going to get a lot of energy. I also think this one's going to be different in that inflation's cornered the authorities. And so the tricks that have worked for the last 40 years, because we had a 40-year bond bull market, or we had maybe vice versa, because they could pump the rates down for 40 straight years, we had this recency bias on that. We're at the end of the rope. We've reached the end of the chain. And so those tricks won't work. And with inflation boxing us in, if they go back to that screwy QE stuff, I think the inflation is so problematic now that it's not going to sell well. I think things like bond interest rates are going to go against them. I think they're going to turn against them. And so I think the 40-year credit cycle has turned. And that's why I think the next few decades are going to be painful. And Napier was on board with that. He really did mention a fundamental transition in the global currency regime.
So last time I spoke with you on the VRIC channel, I chatted with you and Tom Luongo. You said you were very heavy in cash and things like treasuries, fixed income, et cetera, short-term liquidity. But the question is, if you see us in for decades of pain, once this market correction that you see coming does occur, is that a time to buy? Because if we're then in for this long-term bear market, where do you then allocate capital once everything has crashed?
I don't know. I could tell you various things that have various probabilities of working. I think there's reason to believe that the hard assets, I think the hard asset big cycle might be turning up. If you said take all your cash and shove it into an asset class, I'd probably go into energy. I've got enough gold now. I use metrics of annual salaries. I could have as many as 10 annual salaries of precious metals. That's a lot of precious metals by any metric. I bought a $100,000 violin this week. I do not play the violin, but my son does. And if you buy an early 18th century violin by a famous maker that's in pretty good shape, the zeros start adding on there pretty quick. He's just spent his inheritance. That's what he did. But it's in my name. So that's a hard asset. But it could be a bubble, too, because, you know, bubbles, they all go together. So it could be we bought into – I have antiques that I bought in the early 80s, mid-80s that are still not anywhere near what I paid. So you could get hammered. The best way to worry about it is to imagine of a smaller universe that we'll call the Nikkei and say, okay, so the Nikkei marched its way down slowly, methodically, knocking investors on their ass every time they thought it was done. And then the question is, how would you, if you were stuck with the Nikkei, how would you invest in Nikkei? And the answer is you wouldn't. You would have just gotten crushed and for decades. And I think that's what we're looking at. Did you see the report from the Treasury Department, by the way? I've had a somewhat longstanding, couple of year discussion with David Einhorn about unfunded liabilities. He didn't believe the numbers. He said, no, those numbers are too big. They can't be right. Give me numbers I can process myself. And then Peter St. Ange, who you should have on your show if you haven't had a Peter St. Ange is phenomenal. He published, he talked about a Treasury report, which I went and got some help and found, that shows that, yes, just for Social Security and Medicaid or Medicare, I never can keep those two straight because I'm not quite care, projecting the costs out to infinity and the revenues out to infinity, which is what Kotlikoff did many years ago, were $175 trillion in the hole. And that's 1.4 million per taxpayer. Now you can say, we don't have to pay it. We'll kind of inflate it away. And I go, okay, so they're going to inflate away 1.4 trillion worth of your net worth. I don't care how they do it. It's still 1.4 million, excuse me, million of your net worth as a family. And nobody's ready for that. Nobody's ready for that. Well, yes, there are people who are ready for that, but not Joe Sixpack, not upper middle class boomer.
Do you give much credence to the, some would call it a conspiracy theory out there that there's no way out?
I love conspiracy theory. So
yeah, I know.
The answer is yes.
I've already got you. But that there's no way out for the government at this point. There's no way to pay back this debt. That they're backed into a corner. As you say, inflation's out of control at this point. The very crude tools that the Fed has are no longer working, and that they're going to bring about some sort of black swan event. People are talking about potentially a cyber attack of some kind, or some sort of event where they make everybody really scared of some threat that's out there, and as a result are able to either reset the financial system through the issuance of CBDCs or put some other sort of measure in place that can somehow get them out of the financial troubles that they're in. What are your thoughts there?
I have no problem with the idea of orchestrating it, but I don't think they'll have to orchestrate it. I think society will hand them the opportunity to do that kind of crap anyways. Here's an interesting little nugget that some people know, but I bet most don't. The Great Depression is said by the people who studied it to have really been founded on a credit bubble in the 20s, right? Bernanke seems to be completely oblivious, which or that, or he's a liar. And I actually think the liar is the better model. But one of the interesting facets is a Florida real estate bubble was thought to be local, and then it eventually cascaded into a Southern Bank collapse. Then eventually, and a lot of people think it really was a very important cornerstone of the Great Depression. Now, what popped it? Well, it turns out the event that is considered the first, you know, you're walking on ice, you hear a cracking noise, you go, what was that, right? What was the first crack? Bear Stearns internal hedge funds collapse, right? First crack was in, I think it was 1926. A ship got beached in Miami Harbor and cut off transported materials into Florida for 40 days. They said, although they got it out of there 40 days later, the bubble had begun to pop. And I'm going, let me think about this. What, we have anything like that? Like Baltimore, some bridge go down, you know? And I think the consequences of that port going down are going to be bigger than a lot of people realize. But that's just a trigger. That's the butterfly flapped its wings. I talked to a Canadian military intelligence guy a couple of days ago, and he says when you talk to people at his level, either in Canada or in the United States, they're nervous about hot war. He says the higher up the chain you go, the more nervous they are. And so he thinks hot war next couple of years is in the cards. Now, will we start it on purpose? Motivation, I can't say, but it won't. And I also said, and this won't be a hot war where we bomb the crap out of someone and pretend it's a war when in fact it's just another one of our genocides, by the way. Now, we killed 4.5 million people in the Middle East, so we really shouldn't be talking about the morality of other countries doing what they do. And he said, no, it won't be one of those. It'll be a real hot war. And not with Russia, though. I think it'll be with Iran plus their buddies. And I think Russia will be a proxy war. China, it will be a proxy war while we're duking it out with Syrians. And Iran's serious. Iran has way more firepower. And the Baltimore Bridge problem illustrates how susceptible we are to soft targets, right? If someone hadn't thought of that, they sure as heck got the message this week, and they say, well, let's hit another one, right? Go take out one of the New York bridges. I don't know, but that bridge is particularly bleak. So who knows? Yeah, I think something bad will happen, whether it's premeditated or just exploited normal opportunity. I don't know, but I have no problem with the premeditation theory.
So you recently posted on X, when the Fed starts cutting rates, you should run rather than buy the markets. The cuts mean the Fed smells a problem. For some reason, the market often prices in potential cuts as bullish. Can you explain why they're not and why you think that would be the time to exercise the most caution?
Well, first and foremost, I think people are underestimating Powell. I've said this. He acted like he was getting cowardly, but I'm not convinced that wasn't itself sort of a head fake. I think Powell has two fundamental problems he has to deal with respect to the market. One is he has to deal with inflation. I think he also has to get rid of the speculative fever. There's a terrible NVIDIA, right? Just look at NVIDIA. Look at the Mag 7. He's got to pop that. And he can't be watching NVIDIA go up to ridiculous levels and not say, oh, God, this is going to end so poorly. We got to find a way to deal with this. So I think they will start later. If you look and that wisdom of run, don't buy, is just based on history. It turns out if you look at the downturns of the past, which are always tied to Fed tightening, when you look at downturns of the past, when the Fed starts cutting, is often pretty near the market top, actually. And then what happens is it usually takes about a year to year and a half before the Fed is done cutting, and the Fed is done cutting at essentially the bottom. So in some sense, the markets, if we're to put a sort of an anthropomorphic spin on it, respond as though the Fed's cutting because we have a fundamental problem. So they're selling and selling and selling. Just like people who are gold bugs, who often they'll say, you know, gold goes down when the interest rates go up. And I go, no, it doesn't. Interest rates go up because of inflation. Gold goes up because of inflation. Why aren't those correlated in the direct rather than inverse sense? And in the 70s, they were. And so I think that, crudely speaking, looking at former downturns, the bulk of the damage was done while the Fed was cutting. And that's just historical observation. It doesn't anything beyond that. It's just an opinion as to why.
Well, let's talk about gold here, because obviously we're sitting at nominal all-time highs. It's broken 2,200 now. Got a lot of the aforementioned gold bugs you mentioned very excited. However, if we adjust for inflation, obviously we're still a ways away from all-time highs. What are your thoughts on gold's breakout here, and how do you see it performing moving forward?
I don't know on the last question. Every time I start getting excited, I'm like, you know, the way you beat an investor down is you knock them down repeatedly. I've owned gold since 270, so I really don't watch the wiggling as much as most people because I can say I have an X bagger. No matter what it does, it's still a big win, unless it goes to 270. Then I've gotten my ass kicked. I don't know. Gold could be readying for another big run. There's you know, plots on the internet showing that central bankers are starting to really stockpile it in earnest again. If there's a big currency regime change going on that potentially multi-decade, that would potentially, it's conceivable that the BRICS, instead of setting up a currency, are just going to try to tie themselves back to gold again. I think the people who say gold is not a monetary metal anymore, I think they've probably lost the plot. Does Bitcoin cannibalize gold? I actually don't think too much, maybe a little. Right now, gold is still a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the investable world in the Western world. And so if gold's going to run hard, you're going to see that change before it's done running, right? There will be indicators that everyone's now NVIDIA level enthusiastic, I think. So I'm pretty confident that being in gold is not a terrible idea. It could turn out to be a bad idea, but everything could, right? having kids could turn out to be a terrible idea, right? So,
of course, yeah. Now, what are your thoughts on silver? This is a metal where sentiment is extraordinarily low, especially when it comes to the mining sector, but the metal itself as well. I think we had a situation where this whole silver squeeze movement started. A ton of people bought a ton of physical silver, thinking that somehow they were going to drain the COMEX and that prices were, and they were going to have a GameStop moment where silver prices went to the moon a la Hunt Brothers. That did not happen. I think we have a lot of dejected people now who love to leave comments on YouTube about how much silver sucks. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on silver. Obviously, people always say that in the silver tends to play catch up and then outperform gold in the latter stages of a precious metals bull market. Do you see things that way? What are your thoughts on silver right now?
Well, I think the guys posting stuff are nothing as who move it. They're more of a, just an indicator of what it's been doing, right? So they're going to be enthusiastic if it's going up, and they're going to be pessimistic if it's been going down. So I could tell you what the YouTubes look like just looking at the chart. Again, my cost basis of silver was over a period of time, but it started at around 380 an ounce. And so, again, I'm pretty sanguine about silver, although I would love to get to have it become a contributor again to my net worth. But it's complicated. What I like about silver is that unlike gold, it's consumed. Now, a lot of people try to make the case for gold, saying, well, you know, gold has uses. I go, no, it's an error bar. Gold, you could stop mining gold at this point and then use gold for all the industrial applications, and it would last for centuries. It's a ridiculous argument, in my opinion. Silver, on the other hand, does have uses and does not sort of stay in vaults on the Earth's surface and anywhere near the quantities, and really could have supply problems. And so, over the 20 some odd years I've owned it, you get guys saying that we're in deficit production now, and then we're in surplus production. It gets complicated because it's a byproduct of mining of other metals. And so I don't know how to analyze it, really. I just know that it seems likely to track gold, maybe lead gold, but right now they're about the same. So I like silver. It wouldn't trouble me to buy more. I don't need more, but it wouldn't trouble me to buy more.
And last time we chatted, you were bullish on platinum as well. Do you still feel that way? This is a commodity that is not often discussed. So walk us through your thesis for platinum.
As in never. My thesis is simple. Platinum, I think, has been beaten up by the premature demise of the internal combustion engine, for starters. People thought it was the loss of photography. The recycling in photography was so efficient that it was not even a consumer of silver. Silver is in every electronic device in the world. So in terms of industrial application, including solar panels and things like that, but I don't think the solar panels are a big consumer. I think it's just the fact that your microphone, my screen, everything's got silver in it. Again, it's one of those things where I won't be shocked if it disappoints. I went back to silver. Platinum, I think the EV world is going to collapse a little bit. I think it's not going to go to zero, but disappointments are starting to show up in a very big way. The rental agencies can no longer buy EVs because they can't sell them. The used market for them is terrible. The battery replacements are anywhere from $7,000 to $30,000. I think the EV story is going to collapse because I don't think they work that well. I think they're fun to drive, but they don't work that well. They might get better. They're not going to outlaw internal combustion engine, in my opinion. They will temporarily, and then people will scream at the top of their lungs. Platinum hasn't moved in 20 years. I have about 5 ounces of platinum, and I still have 5 ounces of platinum, but I'm not buying a yacht with it. So I'm optimistic that maybe it will become the metal that's been unloved, and people will find it. So I wouldn't say bullish was the word. It's a contrarian play, which I should add. RSX was a contrarian play too, and that worked out so well. And so I think platinum could be rediscovered. It has been beaten. It has been at 900 an ounce plus or minus change for 20 years at least. And it, if it ever went to, A, we need more of it than we're getting, it's all coming from South Africa and I think Russia. I think it could move. I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a famous hedge fund manager, and he said, "You're the second person I know who's mentioned platinum. I got to look into it." The fact that he's only had two people mention it to him is an important point. So let's say it went through the various cycles and ended up a meme metal, right? Platinum will have been a great investment because it'll soar. It'll go to, you know, 20,000 an ounce at some point. So it's just, at some level, it's a guess. The platinum miners are a bit of a mess right now. Some of them are working well. Sibanye sucks. Sibanye did what miners often do. They hedged in screwball ways and stuff. And I watched the CFO get interviewed on a podcast, and boy, I was uninspired by him. Like, oh, shit, I can't believe I own Sibanye. Big dividend, but I think Sibanye had to cut its dividend. So they're unloved. They're relentlessly unloved. So that's my bullishness. It's a contrarian play that isn't contrarian just because it's stupid. Okay, I think it's a legit contrarian play.
And you mentioned you think that the EV narrative is overdone here. I'd like to get your thoughts on the broader ESG push, because it looks like a lot of the politicians and the powers that be that are pushing this agenda are determined to go all the way to the end, regardless of whether this is going to work or not, regardless of whether physics is on their side or not. It's become an ideological, almost religious mission to just push this as far as it can possibly go. So I'm wondering how you see this all coming to an end. Will there be an awakening moment where people go, this just doesn't work, let's try something else? Or will they keep pushing this until more and more people are thrust into poverty because of insane regulations? What are your thoughts there?
Well, the latter is certainly a possibility. There's no reason that says that it can't just end up in poverty. The ESG movement is a cult at this point. Wall Street can monetize a cult, so they're happy to do so. And I think it will end. I think it will, the odds on favorite end will be when we have our next downturn. We're like in an interglacial period, right? We had a glacier back in 2008-09. We're going to have another one going forward during periods where everything's incredibly flattering and everything's rolling along. You have the luxury of being able to think stupidly and come up with ideas that don't actually hurt you. But if you interview or poll people and say, how much would you be willing to sacrifice to save the planet? It's usually about a McDonald's drive-through lunch in terms of magnitude. And if you say, look, would you be willing to give up, you know, $1,000 a year of your salary? They go, oh, no. And so once people figure out that, and you know, that's starting to become clear, for example, with the Ukrainian war, people are starting to go, no more money to Ukraine, right? I mean, it's becoming politically problematic. We'll do the same with ESG, I think. I think the ESG thing is a luxury. And when the next downturn will luxury goods will go away.
Interesting. I wonder, I would like to shift to Argentina for just a moment here and Javier Milei. What are your thoughts on his presidency so far? Obviously, he's followed through on some of his campaign promises. I spoke to Gerald Celente and I asked him, how do you feel about Javier Milei? Is he the real deal? Is he just another scumbag? And Gerald was not kind with his words. He said he's just another parasite, and he's just there to kind of say whatever's politically expedient and to maintain his hold on power. What are your thoughts on Javier Milei? Can he save or at least make the economic situation in Argentina better?
I don't have anywhere near the data I would need to be that confident. Salente is an interesting character in its own right. I mean, talk about the doomer, right? I mean, this guy's been squealing a lot for many years. I would say that what he's done so far is provocative. Is he serious, or is there some play, some grift behind the scenes? I don't know. I'm not convinced. You and I both want the United States to be the good guys. I'm having trouble convincing myself that narrative is correct. I think we like to be the good guys when it's in our best interest, but I think we're as savage as any country when it's necessary. Foreign policy in South America has not been terribly friendly to South America. And there's a book called Overthrower. It talks about 13 governments that were explicitly overthrown by the United States. And that starts out by saying, look, there's tons where our fingerprints are all over the damn thing, but it's not explicit. And a lot of those were in South America. And so I think our foreign policy generally is to not support democracy. We tolerate democracies that can't be uprooted, like Germany and places like that. But I'm pretty confident that our deep state would rather deal with one guy wearing a white suit, sunglasses, and a cigar, because you just have to control that one guy. Whereas democracies are inefficient and ugly and unpredictable. And so we will knock out democracies to get, and if Malay's doing what we want him to do, then he's in great shape maybe, but I don't know if he is. And if Argentina starts getting strong, will the United States go, oh, that's good? Will the deep state say, oh, that's good? Or will it be, oh, now such and such of exports, imports, trade balance, whatever. I'm not smart enough to know whether they want, but I do know that in the Middle East, any country that starts looking stable, we destabilize. That's the pattern that keeps showing up. The country starts looking stable. You know, you can say Assad's a bad guy, but, you know, Syria is stable. And we tried this, right? We took out Gaddafi when Libya was looking stable. And we took out Saddam when Iraq was not disruptive. We told him to take out Kuwait. We told him to take out Kuwait. And he did. And then we bombed the shit out of him. And we're bombing Yemen for reasons I don't understand. We're picking on Iran for reasons I don't understand. We're picking on Russia for reasons I don't understand, although I can invent some. So will Malay get caught in some crossfire because he's doing what we don't want him to do? And if he is, we'll take him out. So can you tell me what you think? Is Malay doing what we want or not by that model? Do we?
Yeah, I would say. I would say Malay is not doing what the U.S. wants.
Right. If that's the problem.
Yeah. However, there is a narrative out there that the U.S. is no longer capable of the same sort of, whatever you want to call it, their involvement in foreign nations over the course of recent history, which has been very bloody and very monstrous when you really take a close look at it. There's the narrative out there that their power is starting to wane and they no longer have the capability of, like, taking somebody out like they used to. And many people point to the BRICS nations alliance as kind of a sign of the times that they're seeing that weakness, you know, the pullout of Afghanistan, just the fact that there's a president who's so cognitively out of it. It blows my mind that there's not riots in the streets. Like, how is this person allowed to be the president?
And to run again.
Yes. Yes. So what are your thoughts on the current state of the real power of the United States? Can they go around dictating to the world, or is there a paradigm shift occurring where we see the BRICS nations, we see nations start to go, you know what, this isn't working for us anymore. We see you're in a weakened state, and now it's our turn to rise.
So here's my rhetorical question. What does history say about when Empire A gives way to, we'll say, Empire B? Is it peaceful? The answer is no. And so we are likely to go down kicking and screaming. And you know, there's famous quotes from the mid-30s from Churchill saying we're going to have to pick a fight with Germany. And I'm going, wait. Didn't Hitler pick a fight with us? I'm not so sure. I think Hitler might have said, holy shit, the Brits are coming. Right? And you've got France shoving troops into Ukraine. please explain to me how anywhere in history sending 2,000 troops into a place like that is anything but a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Because then they'll come back in body bags and say, oh, we got to send more troops. You know how that works. Vietnam was advisors that became 500,000 troops. And so I think, again, the intelligence guys seem to say we are looking for a war. Why? I don't know. Is it just industrial military profiteering? Is it some geopolitical shift that we're not smart enough to understand? I don't know. Luongo is very good at this stuff. His models are sophisticated and compelling. I don't know if they're right. That's a separate issue. And I love chatting with him because he brings so much to the table, but he could have something backwards. He thinks, for example, we're back away from Ukraine and we're pissing off the Europeans. And I think the Europeans wanted nothing to do with the Ukrainian war and would have loved to have gotten to the table and said, okay, Russia, here's what we'll do. We'll stop doing this. We'll stop doing that. And the United States is going, oh, no, 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 you can't. Right. So I view the NATO, a.k.a. the United States, is forcing Europe's hand for some reason. Tom views it the other way somehow. So I don't know. Israel, Palestine, I don't talk about the morality of it because that'd be World War III just on my computer screen. What I will talk about is the risk, which looks big because it could spread very quickly. That's like a burning embers in a bone dry forest, right? And I also will talk. I also asked yesterday in this panel discussion, we talk about it in isolation. We act like it's Israel against the Gaza Strip Palestine guys. And I said, how does this fit in with Europe, Russia, China? It has to fit into that. It is part of the chess match. Where does it fit in? And Tom has his opinions, and I don't yet understand them.
Let's close on this. This program, you know, obviously we've been talking a lot about geopolitics, politics, which I love to do, but ultimately we do try to focus on investing and speculating, particularly in the commodity space, but just overall as well. I wonder, over the years of experience you've had when it comes to investing, are there any thoughts you could leave us with, words of wisdom, or things that you think it's important for investors particularly to be paying attention to in our current market environment?
So I should warn investors that I'm just Joe Sixpack with a mouse. I'm a weaponized mouse holder. And I listen to a brainwashing expert, and I realize, I go, this guy I think is an expert just because he's dug into the internet deep. And so I should not be construed as an expert. I think I have a good bullshit meter. No fear of being contrarian. I thrive in contrarian. And so I'm a natural contrarian just to piss off people or something. I am now fully hunkered down for the apocalypse. And so I have gold and a lot of sort of 2-year treasury notes. I have some exposure to the normal markets and accounts that I don't control well. And it's been good news because if I controlled them, I probably wouldn't have done as well as by letting them run. But I think I'll pay that back. The problem you have is that when the market really tightens, when things really tighten up, when there's really sort of unemployment and soaring this and soaring that, all hell breaks loose in every sector. Pretty soon you're selling your daughters to make money to put food on the table, right? And that means that there's no asset that you can say with confidence will do well. You will be trying not to lose money during that. And it could include, for the first time in decades, the bond market. Now, we saw in, 2022, where the bond market beat the crap out of people. And if your investing firm was marking to market, you got hurt because your equities went down, your bonds went down. You go, whoa, that was painful, right? In 08, 09, the bonds saved you because a 60-40 portfolio, which a lot of people have 80-20, the 60-40 portfolio, your 60 got clobbered you, but your 40 nailed it. And so in the end, you go, oh, that hurt, but not that badly. What if both go down simultaneously? And if the credit cycle is over, the bonds are done. And if the equities are done, AKA 60, 70, 80% correction, then you're about to be in fetal position. And it, my biggest fear, and it seems like it's almost a mandated event, is that it will take many years. Because if, let's say we crashed over the next calendar year 70%, the very next move would be dip buyers and they would run it right back up. The way you correct to fair value, and again, 70% could be what it takes to get us to fair value, meaning historically normal returns, which means you can't rally from that and call it a correction. You haven't corrected anything if it comes back. You need to go down there, stay there. Now it's a fair price, right? If you have a Toyota you think is worth $400,000, comes down to 80 or 70 or 40 or 50, it's not cheap. It's what the Toyota should cost. And so my biggest fear is time. Time is the friend of a bull market, and time is the worst enemy in a bear market. And I think that the bear market is going to be protracted. Investors will be knocked down. They'll say, I buy the dips. Then they'll get knocked down again. Then they say, oh, I'm a long-term holder. We're okay. They'll get knocked down again. They're going to go, this sucks really badly. And then can the Fed save them? I'm not sure. The age of Fed omnipotence is over if the credit cycle is over.
Very well said. Always love chatting with you, Dave. Thank you so much for coming on today. For those who want to hear more from you, where's the best place to go online?
Twitter. That's almost the only place. I publish an annual review once a year. It's my pinned tweet, so you still find it there. Every year, I swear I can't do it again because it rips my soul out to do it. It's 200 to 300 pages. Try to write something that's 200 to 300 pages at the end of a year, right? You can't write it in April. And so Twitter. I'm a tweetaholic. I love Twitter. I like having conversations with guys like you because it, you know, some will, you don't push back, but you give me a soapbox, and I listen to how it comes out of my mouth. I go, that didn't work, you know. And then other times I go, that kind of articulate. So it's like sparring. I used to do Taekwondo. It's like sparring. You have to kick the crap out of the person to benefit from sparring, And so I realized the other thing about podcasting is, you know, the world's an isolated place, right? We're much more isolated than it used to be. You know, how many I can't even have friends. I can't even go to dinner get-togethers because the politics is too nutty. You know, say, oh, I'm going to vote for Trump. Well, fuck you. I mean, you're toast. You're done. And I have very few friends who can spar and not get in a fight. And I know I can do it. But it has to be a person who can concede something. They got to be able to meet me somewhere in the middle, and most people can't. They really can't. And so doing podcasts with guys like you is fun. I go, hey, you know, you're a friend of mine now. You know, we bond. We that's why I get phone calls from intelligence agents and stuff, because we bonded. And I have. Exchanges with former CIA guys, and I've exchanges with I've in some way digitally met or had dinner with 5 presidential candidates. I mean, what kind of a crazy world is that? I've been to probably 5 meetings with Danielle DiMartino Booth. When does an organic chemist at Cornell get to go to 5 meetings with Danielle, who's, by the way, crazy shit fun to have dinner with? I mean, you know, dinner with Danielle and Grant Williams, right? Tell me you couldn't charge big money for that dinner, right? And so I just love this stuff. So that's why I'm on Twitter. I chat. It's a shit storm though, and I spend less time talking with people I want to talk to, and more time being responsive to people who themselves are trying to be heard. So.
Well, I will put a link to your Twitter in the description below. Thank you once again, Dave, for coming on. It's been a blast.
It is always fun.
Commodity Culture is a podcast that covers investing in commodities and natural resources. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe so you are always alerted of the latest episodes.